Woo-hoo. Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And we're coming in hot from Chamonix. Actually, we're coming in cold, but you especially, because you're wearing so many clothes.
Yeah, it's so against our podcast ethos for me to be wearing a pullover right now.
And pants? And socks?
What's going on with me?
What's wrong with you?
Well, what's actually going on with me is that we're in Chamonix in our little Airbnb, and I haven't figured out how to turn on the heaters here. They're all baseboard heaters. And over in Europe, I'm kind of unsure how to do everything. I'm pretty sure that all of the appliances and everything like that is a practical joke on Americans. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, I feel like if we turn on the baseboard heat, this entire Airbnb is just going to go up in flames. And it's going to be like, I told you so, Americans.
No, I seriously think that all of Europe is set up to confuse me. Like, every little step of it just makes me feel like the stupidest American. I was trying to turn on the stove. And for some reason, the stove heater, it's digital, and it goes up to 14. It goes from 0 to 14 as the heat settings. And I'm like, why 14? It's like the old This Is Spinal Tap quote of like, turn it up to 11. We have 11 notches. They have 14 in Europe, and I have no idea why.
I kind of like it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think it's interesting. They're like designed to be complicated.
Yeah, or maybe just designed to make me feel really, really dumb.
I feel that way with French language. I'm walking around, and my pronunciation in American and like English is horrific. In French, it's even worse. So there's this town, and in my head, I call it Les Hooches.
Yeah, Les Hooches, Megan.
Les Hooches, and that's 100% not the French pronunciation.
Les Hooches is perfect. Yeah, and right now we're in Chamonix. That's right. Yeah, actually, yesterday I was really practicing when I went to the grocery store. And at first, you know, I was just doing my American thing, and I was just saying, excuse me, on your left, thank you, you're awesome. And then as I checked out, I was like, oh, I'm going to try French. And so as I'm there, I was just there with Leo, I was a little flustered. All of a sudden, after she gave me my receipt, I said, gracias. Like, what the fuck am I doing? That's not even the right language.
I'm not surprised. I was so bad at foreign language in college. I did everything not to advance to like the highest level of Spanish and Italian. So I didn't have to do the literature component.
Yeah.
And yeah. Foreign languages don't mesh with my brain.
Don't mesh with my brain. But we're loving France so far.
Yeah. I don't want to leave.
No.
I want to turn the stove up to 14 and stay here forever.
Yeah. It's such a cool experience to travel here with a baby, especially. Leo has been awesome for the most part, though we did have 2 hours of singing him dirty nursery rhymes in the middle of the night last night.
You were incredible. It was one of your best dad moments from midnight to 2 a.m. last night. You were just singing this like 30-minute long lullaby that kept morphing and evolving and getting weirder and weirder and weirder, and it was great.
Yeah, it did. It was pretty good to travel with him, I thought. Like, for the most part, it was like went off without a hitch. When we got to the plane, they actually have bassinets now that you can use for your baby on planes. So it hooks into the wall, which was very cool. But apparently it wasn't made for Leo, because as soon as we put him in it, it was like he wanted to base jump out of the front. He just started getting ready to take a leap. So it was a little bit of a lack of sleep fight, but it worked out for the best.
Well, some of the people that have watched Leo have said they see Alex Honnold in his eyes. It's so actually true. Fascinating. Like, I feel like he doesn't quite have that fear mechanism yet. It's a little bit scary as a parent, because I feel like at 10 months, he should be having that fear mechanism. But as soon as he was in that bassinet, he was like, my dream is to base jump. But we didn't really use the bassinet, but it was actually great, because the bassinet puts you in like the front of economy, and you get all this leg room and all this like base jump landing area. And Leo got to sit on the floor and play. And it was actually a great life hack. Like, if you have a baby, I feel like book that not for the bassinet, but for like the huge leg room that you get in the front of the plane.
Or if you don't have a baby, because
true, like, do they just bring a baby doll.
Yeah.
Be like, my baby doll's going to base jump out of here.
Did they ever check to see if Leo had a pulse? No, they did not. He could have just been a comatose baby. It's like the people that travel in HOV lanes for, you know, like three riders in your car, and then have a crash test dummy in the front. We could just
That's genius, by the way.
We could just have a baby doll, and all of society opens up for you. You get to the front of lines. You get the place with leg room on planes that you don't have to pay extra for. You get to check extra bags. Any baby stuff you fly with free.
Which we didn't learn for like 7 months. So we definitely paid our way for a lot of baby bags. And then someone showed us that, and we're like, oh shit.
So that was a really cool thing on the plane flight. Also, the Lufthansa airline food. The dinner I had was the best dining experience of my entire life. And I will always remember that.
It looked like dog food.
Megan, I don't care. If that's a dog food, I want to be a dog. If that's dog food, then woof, woof.
Everyone around was kind of poking at the food, and Devin was just chowing down like a golden retriever.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
Yeah, it was honestly one of the best experiences of my entire life. And what made me realize, actually, and this is a reflection I had on the plane that I had to bring to podcast listeners, is I'm pretty sure any airline out there could make billions of more dollars if they did a partnership with Trader Joe's.
With Trader Joe's?
Yes.
Okay, this is a bad time to talk about that. Have you been aware of the news on Trader Joe's?
Oh, wait, what? What's that?
Oh, they've had like 5 different recalls of foods in the last 4 weeks.
Okay.
For things like rocks and insects and all kinds of things just like infiltrating broccoli cheddar soup.
That doesn't surprise me, but that's what gives it flavor.
I was going to say, I had a feeling you didn't know this, but yeah. I was also going to say that you were going to affirm this.
Of course.
I was fully confident in the fact that you were like, give me crickets, give me rocks, give me all those.
Give me crickets or give me death. Have you ever had Trader Joe's frozen food? It is so... so good. If that comes from the mealworm, then I am okay with that.
Did you know mealworm is a thing in France?
What do you mean?
They serve it in France. It's no, actually...
You're just punking me now.
No, I'm serious.
The first restaurant we went to, of course they had like snails, like escargot was at the top of the menu, and it was like a cheap restaurant. So French so far have been living up to the culinary stereotypes.
The first restaurant we went to had escargot on the menu?
Yeah.
We didn't talk about this. It was... I would say probably the cheapest restaurant in Chamonix, which is fitting with our lifestyle. I didn't realize they had escargot.
I didn't see the mealworm though. But any restaurant or any airline could really, really up their game if they partner with Trader Joe's, because I feel like anyone would go to that airline just for the food, because you know they're so good at frozen foods. So that's my big $1 billion idea, is to bring together Lufthansa and Trader Joe's into a match made in heaven.
Would you throw in any other like collaborations in there? Like, you know, like a sleep company or anything else? Yeah, I feel like this is an opportunity to like collaborate, David.
I like it. Maybe Theragun.
Genius.
Percussive massage.
Yeah.
Because like, it'd be pretty sweet to get your legs just pulverized while you're flying over the Atlantic Ocean. What do you think about that?
Oh, I love that. Prevent DVTs.
Yes. Exactly. So as you can tell, we're having a great time here in Europe. It's so cool. A couple little reflections before we get to the races. One is that honestly, everything is less expensive in Chamonix, which is way different than I expected. I kind of expected food to be so highly priced. Maybe it's a sign that the US has gotten like pretty rocked by inflation. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I was curious about that. I think it's a sign that we're also going to some of the cheap and really good places here in Chamonix. I bet you there are places that are expensive.
Yeah.
In fact, the grocery store I was just at, I take Leo for like our morning baguette walk, and it was a little more expensive than the first grocery store we're at. So I don't know if we're comparing the right thing, but I agree with you. It's interesting. I feel like US prices have really skyrocketed recently.
Yeah, and who knows why that is. I mean, you're right, that we're just going to the absolute holes in the walls that serve purely like unintentional mealworms. Everything is just contaminated across the board.
Or the conversion rate is 1.08 to US dollars.
Yeah.
So in some sense too, I feel like because it's so close to one, I'm like, it's the same. The same. But the 0.08 probably does add up.
That's a way to really get me. Number two is food labeling is really interesting here.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I don't get it. So what they do, anyone that's ever had European products, even if you're in America, knows this, that they show like nutrition on a per 100 grams basis, which makes zero sense to me. Like, I have no idea what's going on. Why would you possibly do that? Foods, their mass isn't what you're consuming. You're not like, oh, I'm going to have 100 grams of this. That's totally irrelevant to what we're doing here, right?
Oh, I agree. I wonder if it's to standardize it. So you think about like everything on 100 gram spectrum. But I didn't even realize this. You realized this within the first trip of the grocery store. And I've been walking around for many days, not even looking at food labels.
Yeah. Well, Europeans always shit on Americans for being unhealthy or whatever. And I think the only reason that maybe Europeans have slightly lower BMIs across the population is just because they have to do so much fucking math before they eat. You lose your appetite with all the math that you're doing per 100 grams.
I thought you were going to say walking, because it's curious here. So here we walk so much. I just walked to get a whole thing of groceries. I walked to get our morning baguette. I walked to get literally everything that we need. Whereas at home, our Zillow walkability score at our house is zero.
Yeah.
Like we literally can't walk to anywhere except for trailheads, which is great for us. But I actually love the walking life. I'm
you
all about
the
it.
Walking life?
I love the walking life. I will walk to get all those like 100 gram based foods.
I think in extreme moderation, walking is cool, but too much walking and I'm just tired all the time.
Really?
Walking is a hard work for me.
I get deeply, deeply competitive with the Google walking. You know, it's like for me, sometimes when I'm doing long drives, I lock into this like endurance mindset. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm going to get there faster. I'm going to do this. Every minute that I check off faster than the estimated time, I feel so good about myself. And that's how I feel walking around here.
Yeah.
It's going to morph. I feel like this is how people start running, is they just try walking a little faster. And then today on my grocery trip with Leo, I had a few jog steps.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I was like walking, and then I really wanted to beat the 12-minute estimation. So I did a few jogs.
Yeah. There. It is kind of amazing, the transformation. You have molted like a caterpillar becoming a butterfly in terms of your walking speed.
Oh, I am the slowest walker of all time.
Until it's a problem.
Until you put me on the clock.
Yeah.
And then I walk really fast and mix in some jog steps and keep it spicy.
Yeah. You're beating the Google Maps estimations of walking time by so much. I'm really, really, really impressed. It's kind of remarkable. Final little note on France food is they have a Nutri-Score where they rate things through A through E or F.
Yeah, it's this whole algorithm. I went online yesterday and oh yeah, there's this whole algorithm of how to do the Nutri-Score. And of course there's politics involved in it too, because I imagine if you bump up your Nutri-Score, people might think about it a little bit better. But I don't like it. I don't think we should be grading food.
I don't either.
Yeah.
All food gets an A+ to me.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. Except like, you know, random, we've called, you know, some vegetables are just pre-poop.
Yeah.
So like, I feel like a pure vegetable that just goes right through you, that's maybe a C. Everything else is an A. Like at one point they gave my cheese a C and I'm like, fuck you. Cheese is an A. And we're in France. That is not okay. If you give brie a C, then none of us have a chance. Like that curve is broken.
It's just mealworms that are an A. Trader Joe's and mealworms that are an A. But your Nesquik was an E, which is the worst reading. And
was it an E?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, I didn't actually look at that. Are you sure?
Yeah, 100% sure.
Oh my gosh. Well, that gives me some conflicted feelings. But you know what I'm going to do?
What?
I'm going to prove everyone wrong, because they're like, you can't excel with E Nutri-Scores. And I'm like, no, this is A+ fitness that comes from my E Nutri-Scores.
I should just start crossing it out on all of our labels and just put A+.
That's so perfect. Okay. Now a few reflections that are based on trails and things like that as we go into the athletic topics after our very fun vacation reflections.
Well, after our vacation reflections, people are like, you guys are kind of shitting on Chamonix, but for real, I don't want to leave.
Yeah.
This place is incredible. From the first 10 minutes we walked in, it felt like home.
Yeah, the nature score is an A.
Yes, yes, exactly.
It is remarkable.
The nature score is a B.
Yeah, and I think that gets to one of the things that we love the most here are the trails. And the first kind of like important reflection when it comes to the races that are coming up this week with UTMB, why we're here is to coach at those races, is that the vert flows so much easier in France so far that we've seen than it does in Colorado or other places in the US. Like the types of vert ratios you see here scare me as a coach so much less after getting to run on those trails and seeing the numbers just go so much higher. Like my VAM, which is a calculation that measures your ascent per minute, essentially, or per hour, was immensely higher at the same heart rate than it ever is in Colorado. And I think it's a huge opportunity for US-based athletes or North American athletes to take away some of the mystique. Mm-hmm. Whatever fear you have about these trails is misplaced. Yes, they are not easy, but they are not as hard as they seem.
Yeah, and I think for us, we're so used to seeing this type of terrain and this type of steepness at really high altitudes.
Yeah.
So I feel like when I've run these parallel equivalent trails, it's been at 10,000 feet to like 14,000 feet when I am breathing like racehorse, very loud.
Yeah.
And here it's like, because it's lower elevation, so Chamonix is around probably like 3,500 feet.
Yeah.
I just feel like there's this abundant oxygen and I'm running uphill and I'm like, this does not feel as hard as I expect it to. And I think for me, that's probably a lot of the reason, is that there's just so much oxygen in the air.
Yeah. And as so far, the trails I've seen are relatively well graded. Like they make a lot of sense. And I always assumed that the trails were much more just ridiculous than they have been in what we've gotten to see. So,
well, that being said, we're doing this podcast right now as TDS is going on.
That's true.
And TDS is one of the gnarliest races in like probably in the entire world. And so I think those athletes probably have a little bit of a different opinion.
Yeah, they probably do. As some of the UTMB course is really hard. I mean, it's all difficult.
Yes.
I just think that sometimes people get incredibly scared by these races. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they need to be nearly as much. Actually, this is a reflection that I had. It reminds me a lot of US basketball versus European basketball in the 90s. So there used to be this stereotype that European players would come to the US and they were all soft. They're just soft as hell and weren't very good at like the actual dynamics of the NBA, playing at that level. And I think similarly, we have the reverse stereotype of U.S. athletes coming to Europe, especially at these races, mm-hmm. where U.S. athletes are soft. They can't handle these trails. And what we've seen in the NBA is that has been reversed, like from Dirk Nowitzki all the way up to Luka Doncic now. We've seen that Euros are taking over. I mean, Giannis Antetokounmpo is, you know, one of the best players on earth, you know, multiple time MVP, and they're tough as nails. And it took athletes coming over, understanding that the mystique was misplaced, totally destabilizing that narrative. And now, you know, European players are dominating in the US. Similarly, I think US athletes are coming over here more and more. And I think more and more the mystique is going to be totally destabilized. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see U.S. athletes doing incredibly well. We're going to have some Giannis Antetokounmpos out here at UTMB races this year and in future years.
Well, who do you think is the American man that's the Giannis Antetokounmpo?
I pronounce that horribly.
Who?
You know what I'm going to say? I don't want to put anyone on the spot. But
are you going to say Jim Jim?
I'm going to say Jim Jim. Well, I think Jim is he's a great example. He's the Dirk Nowitzki of this mm-hmm. because he's really coming over, establishing himself and, you know, doing incredibly, but also, you know, hasn't had that like win breakthrough yet, but I think he's going to. That being said, he's also moved here and trained on these trails and things like that. What I'm very excited for is athletes that just come here, crush a race and then fly back. Because I think it'll take away the mystique even more. Because like, if Jim wins, we'll just say, oh, well, he's become French. Some people will say that. Yeah. And that's a little bit different, I think.
Well, after living here, I'm like, how many US trail runners are just going to become French?
Yeah.
Like us. Like that. I feel like we're trying to embrace our destiny of moving here.
Now, ever since you said Nesquik on E Nutri-Score, I'm like,
you're out.
I'm out. I can't take it. If I knew that coming in, I would be so much more down on the European experience.
Well, that's a fair point too. Also, we've had to co-opt like all the different drinking vessels here
yeah.
because I feel like every single drinking apparatus in Europe is designed for like a tea party or something. They are so small. I walked into the kitchen yesterday and you were drinking Athletic Greens out of a bowl.
Yeah.
And I felt you so hard because I was like, I'm going to need 45 of these teacups to actually hydrate my body.
Yeah. Everything in Europe is just a little bit smaller when it comes to consuming things, which makes sense.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, I feel like everything. Yeah. It's
yeah.
interesting.
And maybe, you know, we're obviously stereotyping off a very small sample size. But I've been very into using just an actual bowl, like the bowls that you're supposed to use for whatever. What do French people use bowls for, do you think? What?
Soup.
Yeah. French onion soup.
What's yes. Yeah.
The French onion soup bowls I'm using for my Athletic Greens, for my tea, for my protein shakes, for everything. And it's actually quite good. It's just essentially a really big mug.
I think your mug at home is actually bigger than the bowls here.
Yeah.
You should have brought it with you.
I travel with a mug.
Yes. Yeah, travel with your big ass mug.
I do when we're traveling within the US because I have this mug that fits like 40 ounces of fluid. And I think that's what everything should just be really, really big. But you know what shouldn't be big?
What?
The poles. Poles should be less big. One thing we've gotten to see too out here is everyone on every single trail, maybe this is just UTMB phenomena, is using poles even when they are extremely not warranted.
People are obsessed with poles. People like walk to dinner and go up sidewalks with poles.
Yeah.
There are poles everywhere. Like it's kind of wild to me. Actually, yesterday I passed a guy on a run and he like decided to come up behind me
yeah.
and was back there probably for like a minute, just wailing his poles into the ground right behind me, like yeah. 5 inches. It was a little horrifying.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. You weren't even on a steep trail
no.
at that point.
Yes. Yeah. I was running a very chill trail.
Yeah. Yesterday. You had very little vert yesterday yes. on your yeah. run.
I mean, I still had like 800 feet of vert, but for France.
For 8 miles. Like,
yes. Yeah.
We're talking like, you know, just a bike path essentially. And athletes were using poles on it.
Yeah. It was, I mean, I'm not surprised because people use it literally to get up sidewalks around here.
It's so true. Okay. One final thing I want to reflect on is that Chamonix right now with these races coming up. So we start with OCC on Thursday, though TDS is going on right now. CCC on Friday and then UTMB on Friday night. It is a mob scene. It is so crowded and so interesting. Going down Main Street here is a trail runner's dream. It's as if Times Square was molded with like Western states or something. It's a totally different experience than I've ever had. I absolutely love it right now, but I also love it because we can escape to our little nook over here.
Yeah, it's like the highest population density of Hokas ever.
Oh my God,
it's so insane. Many people. It's like a competition, I feel like, to see the brightest shoes that you can wear walking yeah. around Main Street. But I feel like for a lot of people, like for us, it's a dream. Like that's so cool. We're like, we're in trail runners paradise. We are so locked into it. But I imagine if we were racing I feel like an athlete with a lot of nerves heading into a race,
yeah.
it could be a nightmare too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to ask athletes now to be off the beaten path.
Yes.
Just because it is pretty overwhelming, I imagine, if you have to expect your body and brain to step up in a long race ahead. But it's very cool to experience. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, yesterday at the end of my run, I ran through the center of town. Mm-hmm. And
you did that purposely. You didn't have to, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, of course. Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was, I told you I was going to do it the night before, just to see it in action. Like, and whenever I run, I just feel like I totally embody the experience a lot more than when I'm there through other means. It's one of the reasons I love running so much. And multiple times people yelled huzzah from the sidewalks. Like they were at the cafes or whatever, and people would just yell huzzah. So whoever's out there doing that, thank you. It made me feel so at home.
That's so cool. I'm really sad our swap merch isn't in yet, because yeah, we could have decked you out and put like a huzzah little like logo on the back of you, like much like our merch. And it would have been good podcast advertising.
Yeah, so true. And I mean, going down that main street, when you said it's the highest population density of Hokas, it really is a shoe company battle here.
Oh yeah.
Isn't it interesting?
Who do you think's winning?
Well, I think Hoka for sure.
Oh, for sure. There are so many Hokas.
Their marketing's really good, but I would say it's a battle between Hoka, Adidas, Nike, and Salomon. They all have like different approaches, it seems.
Oh, I feel like there's a huge Venn diagram overlap on thick boys.
Yeah.
There are so, and it makes sense here, given the vert and the terrain, that a lot of the sport is coalescing on thick boys, but there's a lot of stack height.
Yeah. And it's just really cool to understand how this sport and the commercialization of this sport is represented at this space right now. And Hoka is doing a great job. Like their marketing is clearly top notch and their shoes are great. Like,
yes. Yeah.
You know, we're huge fans of the Mafate Speed 4. But I do feel like Adidas has come into the game and is really stepping up. I haven't tried the new Adidas shoes.
I haven't either. I've seen them though, and they look like I would like them.
Yeah. I know they're dropping a new shoe this week.
Oh, that's a good time. That's good marketing.
We got invited to some media thing. I think it's
did we really?
I'm not allowed to say the shoe, I think, until, I think it's under embargo or one of those things. But I'm allowed to say the general idea that we were invited to something felt very, very special. But they do seem like they're catching up a little bit, just based on everything that's going on out there. Like Salomon has a much more muted appearance, I would say, at this place than Adidas. Like yesterday when I was at the top of the mountain, I ran past the gondola that mm-hmm. goes up there. And in the big gondola space, they had massive Adidas billboards. In fact, I saw one of our athletes up there.
Oh, so cool.
On the Adidas billboard. Who? Steven. And to me, that was like such a cool moment, because I'm like, wow, they're investing in everything. Meanwhile, Hoka, though, to give you a perspective on how much they're investing, at the Geneva airport, which is the airport people fly into to get to Chamonix, which is like an hour away, there was massive Hoka signs everywhere.
At the baggage claim.
Yeah.
You could sit there for 15 minutes, wait for your bag, and the Hoka videos would just play.
Yeah. And so it's very cool to be in Europe to see more commercialization of the sport than we see in the US. Like Western States is kind of the comparable race to UTMB. And it is such a different vibe there.
Oh, it's so, I mean, Western States, you go to Western States, and especially at Forest Hill and some of these places, it's like loud
yeah.
and vibrant, and you come here and you're like, whoa, that is a small party.
Yeah.
That's like a library party compared to what's going on here.
Yeah, it's almost like Western States is primitive camping, and Chamonix is a big freaking RV.
It's glamping.
Yeah, it's glamping to the max. So we can't wait to experience it all. We'll report back with all of our other reflections, both big and small. And we just feel so much gratitude to be here.
Yeah.
Like, it's so fun to look out our window and see these mountains we've always dreamed about and know we're here and know that this sport has brought us here. And I don't know, for me, like I was almost crying last night as we were going to bed, looking out our window at these mountains, just being like, holy shit, Megan, we did it.
Our bedroom has the best view. So we have this like sprawling view of Mont Blanc out our bedroom. And I stayed in bed this morning for 30 minutes just watching the clouds come and change on Mont Blanc. I could stare at Mont Blanc for kind of an insane amount of time.
Yeah, it is stunning here in a way that it's like almost impossible to describe. It reminds me of some places of the High Rockies, like even like the Tetons or something like that.
Yeah.
But with Europe, the way that the mountains just rise so sharply off the valleys.
The relief is so high. Yeah. Is relief how you would describe it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like awe-inspiring. So like right now, I just turned around and looked at these mountains. They're currently covered in snow since it's been a little bit wet here. The glacier has come almost down to the valley at pretty low altitude. It's like awe-inspiring. And so our recommendation to you is, if you can get out here, not for these races necessarily, because it is a mob scene, unless you're coming to race, maybe wait till a different week, but I would totally recommend it.
Are you glad we did it? Because I kind of had to talk you into this trip.
Yeah.
You were like, oh, it's a lot of travel. We have a baby, which is a very fair point, because he was up from midnight to 3 a.m., 2 a.m. last night. But Are you glad we did it?
I mean, I'm so happy we did it. It actually took running, though, yesterday mm-hmm. to really make me happy that we made the trip. Because before the run, like, it is a lot to travel internationally, especially as a baby.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how I always am. I'm bound by inertia. And you're the person that kind of gets the rock moving. And then once I move, I'm happy there. And almost the inertia flips and I don't want to go back.
Did you know that roach stands for rock?
No.
In French.
Okay. Well, that's great to know.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to get our roach moving.
Maybe that's what I'm finding here all along is my inner Frenchness is coming out. Yeah. Everyone that's ever listened to this podcast just looks at me and is just like, you know what? He seems really French. I'm sure that's what it is. All of this exclamation and really excitement in all of my gracias nature. So maybe I'm just embodying my inner Frenchness.
You seem so French.
So French.
I think it's the nose hairs.
I think it's all those kisses. Okay, amazing podcast for you today. We're going to get to a few UTMB race thoughts just in passing, and then tons of science to really dig into today, from physiological resilience to some anthropology from evolution to heat training and some of the fascinating data on that. We really can't wait to talk to you about it. We've been just taking the flight and researching different things. It was a great time to just sit down, get down and dirty with some new science.
Yeah, nothing like an international flight to really make you ponder podcast notes. You were taking notes on your phone of just random things. Like at one point I saw Trader Joe's go on there.
Yeah.
I was like, that's actually why I researched Trader Joe's.
Oh,
and they were relevant. They were in the news.
And there was a lot more on that list that didn't make it in that I really wanted to talk about. So maybe we'll sprinkle it in throughout.
Can you give me one more thing? I'm putting you on the spot.
Okay, so I was listening to the audiobook by Dave Grohl mm-hmm. called Storyteller, which is wonderful. Everyone, read that book or get it on audiobook. It's fantastic. And what he was talking about there is in the context of genetics, that he had this musical gene, essentially, that just needed to be expressed. His parents understood that. And once it did express itself, it really fully came to the surface. And he lived his life by that. But the way he described it that I thought was fascinating is that instead of thinking about genetics as this mean of base pairs flowing throughout your body, the way he thought about it is he was channeling specific individuals on his family tree's history that were coming out through his music. So Dave Grohl was the drummer for Nirvana, then the lead singer and honestly, whole engine behind the Foo Fighters, one of the biggest bands, and then also the drummer for Queens of the Stone Age. And I loved that idea. So like every time I'm out running, when I was out running yesterday, I was just thinking, you know what? I guarantee there's some ancestor I don't know about who would like run to the corner or something. And that's who I'm channeling, and that for me, it anchored me in the past in a way that gave me a lot of motivation.
I love that a lot.
Was that cool?
Yeah. I think it's like thinking about like deep lineages, but when I've been in the French grocery stores, I feel like I'm just channeling my awkward Uncle George at the Thanksgiving dinner table. I'm like, oh no, I've become that guy.
Yeah, the awkwardness goes many generations.
Yes, many, many generations.
All the way to our like cave person ancestors who were just sitting there and like, they were at an orgy or something and they're just sitting in the corner of the orgy just being like, damn, I don't know when to tap in at this orgy.
They're like, les hooches. Uncle George is like, les hooches.
Les hooches. Just sitting in their corner saying less hooches while everybody else bangs.
Yeah, yeah. And no one corrects them.
Okay, can I have one more reflection on the
book? Yes, yeah.
It was on adversity. And I think Dave Grohl's story is really a fascinating tale in someone dealing with adversity. He seems really enlightened in this fact. So when he was just 17 or 18 years old, he started as the drummer for this already established band called Scream. It was a punk band.
What a great name for a band, by the way.
He's all in the punk scene.
Like if we were to have a parallel named running thing, it would just be Sprint. Oh. Yeah. Strides, actually.
Shart. Shart. The swap band. But what I found really fascinating about that is so when Scream hit a rough patch where essentially they weren't able to get gigs and the money just stopped, he immediately reached out to this little band that was looking for a drummer called Nirvana. That was unknown at the time. And so the way he responded to adversity was just being like, okay, the next opportunity will arise. And then Nirvana, met a tragic end, obviously, when Kurt Cobain, had death by suicide. I don't know exactly how we're supposed to refer to that nowadays. And what he did in response is he went into the studio solo, recorded every single instrument on a demo just for himself, just to say he did it. And that first demo became the Foo Fighters' first album of him just playing every instrument. And eventually, he got bandmates and things like that. But to me, it was just so inspiring for someone to face the worst adversity in their professional life and, you know, obviously feel their emotions and things like that, but then come back and like fight for the future they wanted to see just by, you know, putting themselves out there for themselves, not for like quote success or anything like that.
And to me, music is the coolest way to do that. Like, I feel like music is almost this language that I wish I stayed in. Yeah. Unlike like French or Spanish, where I was atrocious at it. I really love the language of music, and it's this act of expression. So we were in Aspen like 2 or 3 weeks ago, yeah. and there were all these like pop-up string quartets associated with the Aspen Music School. And some of the music they played, so they were sitting there playing pop music and clearly like hadn't played some of these songs before. Yeah. And I don't know, I got kind of choked up listening to it, which is not something that's like not usually an emotion that I think about when I listen to music, or it's kind of not my nature, just like walked around being choked up.
I mean, every time I hear a bassoon, I cry a little. just a little bit inside. It just gets my emotions going.
It's the cello for me.
Oh, it's the cello?
The cello, the deep, deep cello. Yeah. But every time they make a mistake, they would laugh.
Yeah.
And to me, I was like, I want that swag. I think it's like, well, they were like so deep in their language of music, but then they would make a mistake and they would break out of it and just laugh and then get yeah. right back into the music. And it was kind of how I want to handle adversity.
Definitely.
Is hearing that mistake and being like, oh, this is a little silly. Let's get back to it. And I'm sure, you know, they're playing like pop-up music. I'm sure if they were in a like rehearsal or deep in the heart of a symphony, that would be a little bit harder. But it was the most beautiful response that yeah. I've seen to adversity or making a mistake. And it was kind of this group culture of the quartet to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think it comes down to not expecting perfection of yourself or your circumstances,
mm-hmm.
especially the circumstances part, because one thing that I think some people have trouble fully understanding is that once you delve into someone's real life backstory, and coaches get a view of this, teachers get a view of this, basically, as soon as you meet anyone and dig down deep, you see a well of adversity and tragedy that like would be just absolutely heartbreaking if you laid it all at once and had it define a person. And so obviously, like, you know, tragedy is horrible and you need to feel your emotions. But in an athletic life, I think that's so, so important, because every single athlete is going to face tragedy and shitty circumstances like you wouldn't believe. Like, it's such a, you know, broken road.
Oh, it's ubiquitous. Yeah.
But that broken road is like, God bless it, because that is part of being an athlete. And this actually brings up something that I wrote in an athlete's log this week that I think might be relevant here.
And before you share this, yeah. so the context is, you wrote this in an athlete's log about a week ago and you shared it with me. And I was like, who wrote that? Because, I mean, it was so brilliantly written that, I mean, it's yeah. not surprising that it's you, but I just assumed it was like Mark Twain or, you know, some like French philosopher or something like that. And then wait for it. So you put it in the podcast outline
yeah.
like a few days ago, and I read it again. And even though we had that moment, I was like, who wrote that? Well, a second time.
Now you're putting it on too much of a...
No, it's beautiful. So yeah. can you read it? I can't okay. address this.
Here's the quote. Responses to adversity matter so much since it's all inevitable. So if athletes spiral each time, they end up becoming their spirals rather than their strengths.
That's becoming their spirals.
Yeah. yeah. And I mean, obviously it's okay to spiral. It's okay to really feel your emotions, but understand that adversity, injury, things like that, like terrible races, horrible runs, having to take a week or two off because of your family, whatever it is, like whatever adversity you face is fully inevitable and it's part of the process. Try to embrace those things as a part of the process, almost as if they're on your training plan, mm-hmm. rather than things that you need to beat yourself up about. Because if you spend your life, especially your athletic life, beating yourself up, you're just going to wind up going down these rabbit holes of self-loathing. And that's the opposite of what an athletic journey should be.
And I feel like the athletic journey is also, it's kind of a unique journey because time and age matter so much
yeah.
that I feel like when you're in that moment beating yourself up, you're also probably fitter than you'll be in the future. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it's interesting for me because it's like, I'm in my athletic prime yeah. right now. And even when I'm injured or like dealing with suck, that's still better than I'm going to be in like 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a wild reflection to have that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the relation with aging is pretty fascinating. It brings up something we talked about on Patreon last week, that you are in your youth now. Mm-hmm. So embrace it.
Yeah.
No matter where you are, like if you're 60, you're going to look back at when you're 65 and be like, oh my God, I was so young. I had so much ahead of me at that point. Similarly, you know, now you sitting here at 33, I'm sure you feel that way about 28.
Oh, for sure.
You
yeah.
know, we like, all think about
my body was able to recover so fast.
yeah. And that is kind of ubiquitous human experience. So embrace the now, whatever it involves, even mm-hmm. the adversity involves, because
yes.
like this is your prime.
Yeah.
Like, and you're always like on that trajectory of things getting better for sure. But it also, there's an inevitable decline that comes over very, very long periods of time. So embrace your youth. I tell this athletes all the time. It's like, this moment is the moment because you get one shot at this. And every moment you try to spend only thinking about the future becomes a moment that you're not embracing and not fully understanding that this is the time you're going to look back on as when you had the most athletic opportunity and life opportunity.
But also for me, it's about not thinking about that too deeply.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you ever feel there's like this, I wouldn't say it's pressure, but I recognize right now, like right now is one of the greatest times of our life. Yeah. Like Leo is such a fun age. We're in an athletic prime and I love it so much that I almost don't want time to pass too fast. And so I can't, I also can't think about it too deeply too.
But at the
so
same
it's like
time,
recognizing it, but not focusing on it.
Think about the adversity you're going through currently. You know, we talk about some of it on the podcast, not all of it.
Yeah.
Obviously you have an autoimmune condition. You got an MRI last week. I know you probably don't want to talk about this, but I'm bringing it up because you're like, this is the best time of my life, but it shows why you're, you know, a magical soul.
Yes.
Yeah. You got an MRI that essentially, you got an MRI for back pain, thinking it was like sacroiliitis, which is an autoimmune response. And your back came back okay.
Yes.
But there were some other findings in there. I don't know if you're comfortable
sharing.
They were
not amazing. You can share them. You can put words to them.
Okay. Essentially, her entire pelvic area is fucked.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Might need surgery.
Yeah, but you're running and you're
and actually
good.
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild. I got the MRI back and it was one of those WTF moments because I don't have pain. It's a very strange situation where the MRI looks 100% worse than how I feel. So we're just rolling with it at the moment.
Nothing is attached. Let's say that way. Like if the pelvis is like a basketball net.
Things are ruptured, which is not a good word to have in an MRI. Yeah. Yes.
If it's a basketball net, it's on the ground. We just have a rim. That's all we have right now. And you're saying, this is the time of my life. I'm in my athletic prime. Seize the moment. But that's what it's about, right?
Yeah.
That's the adversity.
Yep.
You're in it right now. And you're probably going to be going through it for a while, realistically.
Yes.
Like that MRI doesn't just come with nothing after the fact. Though, you're going to test the theorem.
I know. I went for an 8-mile run yesterday and I was like, I feel fine.
Yeah, you feel great.
Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah.
Yeah, the other week you said, oh, David, I'm going to go elliptical. And then a little bit later, you were like, I couldn't lie to you. I actually did a treadmill workout. And when I went down to use the treadmill, the fan was facing the elliptical, which means you really thought about your deception that you directed the fan away from the treadmill so I wouldn't suspect anything.
My brain is an interesting place because like I'm pretty good. I like think very deeply about deception. And then when it actually comes to sharing it, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I literally cannot lie to you. And so it's like, there's all these traces and acts of deception. And then I'm like, oh, look, I actually ran on the treadmill.
But I had loved it in a certain way. You're like, you know, after I found you out or you told me, essentially, you're just like, David, I'm a badass.
Well, you texted me and you're like, what were the details of your elliptical workout? And I was like, it was a great workout, .. But it was actually on the treadmill.
Yeah. And the point being, throughout this process, I mean, I love that about you. Like, it's all responding to this depth of adversity where you don't know what your future holds. And every single day you're like, I'm going to try to have a good day. I'm going to try to make the most of it. And over time, that's created a life that's beautiful. But it wasn't the whole narrative that looks beautiful from the outside. I think a lot of people would go through what you're going through right now and feel depressed and shitty.
And feel ruptured.
And that's ruptured in their soul.
Yes, and in their tendons.
And that would be a valid way to feel. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think your superpowers come from that response to adversity. You know, you're the person that goes into the studio, records every instrument to make a mixtape just for yourself. Because that's all it is for you. It's just for yourself. And if it amounts to anything beautiful on the outside, great. But that's not what motivating you to do it.
Actually, that's one of the biggest recommendations I'm giving to my athletes here at UTMB is sometimes I feel like when you're in this chaos of Chamonix, it feels like you're racing for all of these reasons external to yourself. And the biggest piece of advice I'm giving to my athletes, especially athletes at the top level, there's like, they're being watched. They're literally, there's helicopters here filming the races.
Yeah.
Is do this for yourself.
Definitely.
And I feel like make music for yourself, go run, go train for yourself, like live life in the present moment, in the prime for yourself. And the more I come back to that for me, it's so, so helpful.
Yeah. And yourself and loved ones, I would say sometimes.
Yes,
You know, having some like external sharing of the load is really helpful. Like you've done that with your health stuff. Now we have our full podcast. We weren't planning on talking about this. I'm not sure. Are we going to edit that out? Are you okay sharing
I'm
it?
Good. Yeah.
Okay, you're good. But I mean, for me, like I'm so inspired by the way you're dealing with that and like the way you're conveying it to athletes too. So when you're out there racing, whatever, like everyone that gives a shit about you just wants you to be happy. And all of these external narratives are, you know, totally ignoring, I think, some of the real bones and gristle of life. Mm-hmm. That's just about day to day trying to make it a good day. And sometimes that adds up to the most beautiful long-term accomplishments. But even if it doesn't, a good day is worth it. And it's been so fun to have so many good days with you here, even after, you know, seeing a pelvis that lit up like a Christmas tree on an MRI. It's actually pretty horrifying to read that report. And I think the way you've dealt with it is just, I mean, it's miraculous to me.
Oh, do you think it's smart?
Do I think it's smart? I don't think responding to adversity is necessarily a smart thing. It's actually an interesting reflection in general and how you think about this stuff. Like, maybe the logical way to respond to these types of pieces of adversity is to curl up into a ball and become a spiral, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, especially if you think about what the future holds and how uncertain it is. But like, that's not what you did.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm fighting logic a little bit with my soul.
Yeah.
Like, well, nothing hurts down there. And so I'm just going to go out and run until I can.
And in my opinion, it's perfect down there. It's just wonderful down there. I give you an A Nutri-Score.
How does it pair with Mont Blanc?
I almost went a step with a joke that we were definitely going to have to edit out. And I self-edited myself because
I'm so curious now, though.
I don't know if the internet's fast enough to really use this editing software.
You should use it.
No, Megan, it involved Nutri-Scores and things down there. Not something we want to do.
Is my Nutri-Score an A at least?
Oh, you're A++++. You break the curve. You're the reason they don't grade an S-Quick well, because they're like, this is even better than that. Okay, actually, do you want to do a couple UTMB thoughts before we get to the studies?
Perfect, yep.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. The first one is, I think this gets back to Team Never Hike. The discussions we have about not hiking too much when you have the opportunity to run a single more step. On these trails, like, I think that sometimes people default to hikes so fast that they're leaving some time on the table. And I'm really curious to see what happens at the races this year, because at least with some of the US runners that we coach, that's become like a huge element of how we try to do things. And at Worlds, it obviously paid off with, you know, a ton of athletes having really great races, including the top North Americans. But I think it'll be relevant here, because every single time you can run, you can step more on these types of trails. It adds up.
It adds up. And it adds up in terms of momentum too. I feel like there's, for me, a certain momentum that flips on in my brain.
Yeah.
Very similar to actually like chasing the Google map. And I start running a few more steps on my walk to the grocery store.
Yeah.
I feel like that applies so much to UTMB, is if you can have that little bit of a sense of urgency in terms of a few more run steps, it makes a big difference. It
makes such a difference. Similarly, fast descending is key here. Even though we talk a lot about climbing is more of a long-term adaptation of fitness, mm-hmm, and approach.
Yeah.
Descending is something that can adapt almost instantaneously.
It's like a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a choice that you got to make every day. So this gets back to mindset. I think so much of descending is, once you dial in the form of quick feet, trusting yourself, essentially going as straight as you can down the trail and adjusting on the fly, so much after that just becomes doing it and believing in yourself. So I think descending is the one place where you adapt to the cap set by your brain. Mm-hmm. And if you think you suck, you're always going to suck. And if you decide you're great, eventually your body's going to adapt so much better to that approach.
And I feel like also too, as long as you practice that, because I feel like if you decide you're great and you haven't really done it very much,
yeah,
your quads decide they're not great quite
sure.
fast.
Yeah. But the cool thing about downhills is you adapt so fast.
Exactly. That's true. Like one or two sessions.
Yeah. The principles of the repeat about effect and the studies on it essentially show that one 30-minute session on a treadmill down a steep grade, that, so like they put the treadmill essentially on these stilts, that the athlete has like 78% less muscle damage on the second session a few weeks later. That's insane. So it points out, you know, if you're able to embody this just once, you know, think about how that repeated bout effect can be harnessed for adaptations.
And I feel like that's where coming here and coming to Chamonix and getting here a little bit early helps a ton, because you do one long run in these mountains and I feel like it prepares your legs a little bit more for the specific fitness. But I feel like that also goes for places like Western States, like go to the training camp.
Yeah.
Like those specific stimuli help a ton.
And that's one of the wild things about these mountains is the downhills are long.
Oh yeah.
In a way that you rarely get, even in Colorado. Like it's hard to find a 4,000 foot descent. And these have 4,000 foot, sometimes relatively non-technical descents. And that is a unique stimulus. So definitely try to get out to these types of trails early. I think it is really beneficial. And then the final reflection that's gonna get into our first study here is that it's all about minimizing your breakdown and improving your fatigue resistance. And fatigue resistance, as we talked about on the podcast a million times, is this amorphous, little understood variable. And it all stems back from when we started coaching. And we saw that some athletes independent of all of their other fitness metrics, would break down less at the end of even relatively short runs. So 90 minutes after 90 minutes into a run after like 1,000 kilojoules of energy burned, we would do a climb. And some athletes would fade way more than others. And some athletes would not fade almost at all. And those athletes that didn't fade much, almost all became champions, or at least champions relative to where their initial baseline was. What were we seeing? At the time, it was barely defined in the research literature. But recently, this field has started exploding. And I think it's so exciting from a training perspective to understand that one of the pillars of endurance performance is just now starting to be understood.
And they call it durability too. So yeah, fatigue resistance or durability. And I love, because I feel like it also encompasses so many of the principles of exercise physiology, because it's like, it's thinking about these principles as you extend out over 2+ hours.
Yeah.
And what happens to the body as, like, you know, lactate threshold is decaying, aerobic threshold is decaying, like, and how are athletes sustaining that over that long period of time?
Yeah. And the weirdest part is we're not exactly sure why this happens.
Yes,
we've gone into our theories. If you want to hear our theories, episode 83 digs into our 10. That might have developed a little bit, but I'm going to add one more term to the mix to describe the same thing. And it comes from a study that just came out this last week. This the term is called physiology resilience. So here's the title. The fourth dimension, physiological resilience as an independent determinant of endurance exercise performance. This came out in the Journal of Physiology, and it essentially adds, 25% more to the field of endurance performance and study in this review. Like, the goal here is to essentially say what we thought endurance performance was needs to be taken a step further, and we need to apply this not just to, you know, this one theoretical review, but to every single study, every single training theory, everything that involves, you know, multi-hour performance.
So this is building off and expanding across the three pillars that have already existed. Yeah. And why I like this is because these three pillars are fundamental, but then this adds the component of time.
Yeah.
And it also incorporates the other three pillars too, in terms of thinking about the decay of these with that component of time. So the other three pillars are VO2 max, running economy and efficiency, and then fractional utilization of VO2. And then we're throwing in fatigue resistance or durability, and I think it's going to be so helpful.
Yeah, and the physiological resilience term makes a lot of sense to me to use here. I love fatigue resistance, but I like how they're framing this. And I think what's so significant about this study is essentially it's trying to take what we know and flip it on its head slightly, almost like you start to see in things like physics, where, you know, Einsteinian approaches change the way we think about time.
Yep.
This is trying to change the way we think about endurance training and really incorporate it into the theoretical model so we can apply it. So here's a quote from the study. The mechanistic basis for such differences in fatigue resistance or, quote, physiological resilience are not resolved. However, resilience may be important in explaining superlative endurance performance, and it has implications for the physiological evaluation of athletes and the design of interventions to enhance performance. Essentially, now we're trying to understand fatigue. And this is something that, like, on this podcast and what we do, we're focused on primarily. And they presented some theories in here for things that matter and things that are important. But I think the main metric to know is the inter-individual variability, like how much one person can vary from the other despite testing all the same in the lab, is massive. So one study looked at it and found a difference between 1% and 32% in terms of how much athletes faded in a simple study protocol, not based on anything they could identify at the outset. How wild is that? Think about the individual variability. And think about, if you're a 32% fader, if you make yourself a little better through training interventions, how much might that alter your performance? It might mean in an ultra, you're going 5 hours faster with no difference in your fitness variables.
Do you know if that study was fueled? Because I feel like fuel is a huge, you think about carbohydrate consumption, and we've been talking a lot on here about food doping. And here is the term again. I feel like we've used it in like four consecutive podcasts. The idea that, like, taking in a lot of carbs helps this variable a ton.
Yeah.
Do you know if they were fueled in that? Because I feel like controlling for that would be fascinating.
I'm not sure. I didn't look at the specific underlying study. I think it was by an author named Clark, if anyone wants to check it out. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. But that's one of the things they theorize here, is that what we might be seeing is an athlete's ability to take in and utilize glycogen. It was one of their primary elements, is carbohydrate consumption probably is really driving some of this, and how much athletes can uptake it, which might depend on their, like, muscle fiber typology and things like that. But food doping and taking in a lot of fuel is maybe the first place to look to, you know, optimize this variable of physiological resilience slash fatigue resistance.
Well, I think it's exciting because so many of the physiological variables, you think about like VO2 max and VVO2, so velocity of VO2 max and lactate threshold and aerobic threshold and your paces at those efforts, so much of that changes very incrementally. Like as elite athletes, if you can get like a 1% or 2% gain, that's really big across those variables. But I feel like carbohydrate consumption and fueling in terms of fatigue resistance, I feel like you're playing with percentage points that are much larger.
Yeah.
And when you think about that magnified across the scale of a long ultra, how exciting that is.
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool because I think this really brings in, I think adding this fourth pillar to the field of exercise physiology incorporates fueling in a way that really hasn't been incorporated before in terms of how we think about it.
That's so true. I didn't really think about that, that this is where it really comes in, that food doping is where it's at.
Yes. Yeah.
I had an athlete that said recently that they've had all these breakthroughs because they're food doped to the gills. And I really love that. Another interesting reflection is we theorize that a large portion of this might have some genetic basis.
Yes. Yeah.
But the authors push back against that slightly, or the author, it's actually a solo author paper by researcher Andrew Jones. It's almost uniformly pretty damn good in older athletes. So in other words, once an athlete trains for a long enough period of time, it improves a lot. So maybe we are starting to see the training impact of this, or maybe we're just starting to see that as athletes age, they become more slow twitch. And so they're better at these variables just naturally. And so aging is an opportunity here. As much as we talk about youth, embrace every year because that should make you better at these types of metrics.
Well, it's like every year, every brick in the wall. And I feel like that, for me, this makes me really excited to get out the door, just be consistent with training, is because this is, in my mind, a more movable and variable physiological term. Yeah. And to me, like, that gives me excitement. Like, oh, I can move the needle. Like, I've trained for so many years at this point, but there's still an opportunity for me to move the needle, especially with age.
Yeah. And maybe that's the big takeaway point on this, is that no matter where you're at, unless you have no fade, which there are a couple athletes we coach who are close to no fade. And so we're working on
Drew, Claire. Yes. Yeah. Throwing out a few of those.
Esther, they're all incredible at this variable. And they can improve, but we're talking again, 1 or 2%, much like lactate threshold would be. But if you're not there yet, which is almost everyone on the planet, you're going to have huge breakthroughs. Just keep putting one foot in front of the other, focus on fueling your body, and the amount of progress you can see in these long events is nonlinear. And nonlinear growth rates are the coolest thing on earth. And so this study makes me really excited as both a coach and an athlete myself, because I think it shows where the weirdness comes in. And where there's weirdness, where there's offsets, there's also huge opportunities.
I know. Embrace the weirdness.
Embrace the weirdness. Okay. And do you want to get to like a weird study? I think this is a good segue.
Okay. I love this study. And I feel like there's so many, I have many hypotheses to talk about, and they're going to be anecdotal, but
I'm pumped.
I'm excited. I feel like this study, we could take it in many different directions. So the study is called Human Energetic Stress Associated with Upregulation of Spatial Cognition.
Ooh.
And this was in the American Journal of Biological Anthropology. And I feel like we've been talking a lot about anthropology on here. Evolutionary anthropology as it relates to endurance exercise. One of my new favorite places of study.
I love evolutionary anthropology, partially because we are never quite sure. So it's really good for pop science or, you know, very intriguing theories, because it's really hard to dig into the exact reasons we've evolved the way we've evolved. But I also think it's fascinating from a training perspective, because every single thing we're doing out on those trails, all the weird shit we talk about, is essentially hijacking like evolutionary processes that have been developed over millions of years for other reasons.
It's like hunter-gathering with a Google map.
Yeah.
So as I'm staring at my Google map, it's like, find elk. And I'm like navigating and trying to get there a little bit faster as I go to the grocery store.
Yeah, Nutri-Score of A+. Elk is right up there. But it's really, really cool because, you know, when we evolved into Homo sapiens, the evolutionary pressures were, you know, variable, but everything from, you know, we talk, obviously food is at the forefront and finding food and things like that. And that's what this study is going to get to, but also how we respond to heat, let's say, how we respond to any sort of resource limitation, which is what running is too. All of it is adapting to our survival. So we're taking survival mechanisms from evolution that would help us procreate and applying it to running a little bit faster in something that means nothing. And to me, that's ultimate use of silly science. And I'm here for silly science.
And we actually throw in some silly variables along the way too, like getting our Nesquik from the plant.
Yeah.
Yeah. how does that impact evolutionary behavior?
Oh my God. Yeah. Could you imagine me as a cave person just going to like the one plant that's sweet and just like sucking the shit out of it, just going to town, like giving that plant fellatio constantly. And everyone's like, what's that guy's problem? And it's like, he's just really into sweet stuff. What can we say? And now I have Nesquik, which makes me a little bit less weird. Okay. So what this did is it looked at cognitive performance after multi-day ultras, two of them. They're ultra X races for people that are interested. One in Jordan and one in Sri Lanka.
And these are long races. So they're multi-day stage races, 250 kilometers for most of the distances over 5 days. So probably elements of like sleep deprivation in here to some extent.
Yeah.
Athletes really, you think about like energy depletion, definitely, especially over these longer races.
Heat as well.
Heat, another big variable.
Was one. And so one of the things they tested was spatial working memory. This assesses the ability to store location information, promoting landscape navigation, and facilitating resource location and calorie acquisition.
And then in addition to spatial working memory, they also looked at some other classic ways of how the brain works. So one of them was reaction time. Another was episodic memory. So like your ability to recall information about specific events. And they wanted to see what was the impact of these multi-day ultras on these different brain and cognitive processes, coming at it from an evolutionary theory that as you're out there spending, you know, if you think about like hunting, gathering and going on these long, long trips, tracking down food, how does that impact your brain processes along with being depleted on a cellular level?
Yeah. So how cool is this design? Because it's trying to look deep into our evolutionary history. We talked about thinking about genetics. So now when we're out there running, we're not thinking about someone that was running to the street corner in 1900. We're thinking about someone that was running from a predator, you know, 10 or 20 or 30,000 years ago, or even longer, if we're talking on evolutionary timescales, like a million years ago, even before the speciation of the Homo sapiens. Like, how wild is that?
You're taking the glass half empty, because I'm thinking about the glass half full. I'm like, they were running to get food. And you're like, they're being chased. Both are very valid.
maybe we're reaching back into our own backgrounds. Yeah. You were from the hunting clan.
Yeah, I was like, I'm getting that elk.
I was from the people that just got chased all the fucking time. Chased and giving plants head. That were sweet. Those are things we did. Okay, so simple results here is that the spatial working memory improved substantially. This was the location-based memory system. Reaction time was around the same. And then the episodic memory performance decreased a lot. So this is like your traditional recall, maybe even an IQ test, that type of thing would decrease a lot in these states.
And I really liked, so they provide a great explanation for why they think this happened and why they think there was these like cognitive changes. So their theory was, and this is a quote from the article, this could be beneficial during energetic deficit. So the improvement in spatial working memory, so the ability to navigate, because it may improve A, the ability to find the way home following a foraging or long distance hunting trip, and B, the ability to acquire food by facilitating recollection of the location and quality of previously visited feeding sites. So to me, it's very wild that athletes going through these long stage race ultras actually got better in their ability to navigate.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes intuitive sense to me. Like, I don't know if you've ever gone out on like a long run or a long ride, and I am horrific at directions, like very, very bad at spatial navigation. But after a long run or long ride, I'm slightly better. Yeah. And I have much stronger confidence. I'm like, I'm going to go to the grocery store that's 15 turns away and I'm going to find it myself.
Yeah, I feel that all the time. And maybe it's just because we read this study and now I'm imposing on it a little bit. But I kind of dispute it as it relates to you. I've been on runs with you where we do an out and back and you just make the weirdest turns I've ever seen. I think you're the exception that proves the evolutionary rule, maybe.
Well, maybe it's because I'm with you and your navigation is so good that I'm like, I'm going to lean on to my other hunter. He's going to be my sight.
Yeah, we're an evolutionary team. Exactly. Our progeny gets both of our genetics, we combine them, and it's not quite as fucked as it is when it's just you.
We're a complicated situation.
Yes, exactly. I love that so much. So it's really interesting as an adaptive response to understand that, like, the spatial memory improves, but while rejecting other parts of the brain.
Yes.
So like, you know, because the brain needs to make trade-offs, it's an incredibly resource intensive organ. It uses so much of our energy all the time. So one of the reasons probably that when we talk about things like food doping, it's so important. It's not just for the body and the muscles functioning, it's for how the brain functions. And fatigue resistance or physiological resilience, which we just talked about, are also nervous system processes, most likely, not just muscular processes. So are we actually seeing the brain in adaptive responses to resource deficiency when we talk about physiology resilience and things like how your brain functions? are we thinking about the brain rather than the muscles? And if so, is that where carbohydrate availability might make even bigger difference? It's not necessarily in how much glycogen is in a muscle your muscle fiber, but how much energy your brain has.
Yeah, and your brain is powering your not only cognition, but also your motivation and drive too. And I feel like if we can think about that and if we can harness some of those brain powers, I think it's going to really help, obviously, like recovery post-ultras, but also like performance during ultras too. And I think, so we haven't really talked on here much about ketones as an energy source.
Definitely.
But like Pro Peloton in the cycling tour uses them quite a bit. And a lot of the theories is that they're beneficial. They cross the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah.
And so they're really beneficial in terms of how the brain is processing.
Interesting,
And I think that's actually pretty key for ultra performance.
Do you think our caveman ancestors were out there like
ingesting with their little ketone esters? Yeah, their ketone shots.
Exactly. But yes, hijacking evolutionary processes, which makes me a little nervous sometimes.
Yeah, I don't love ketones for it because it's like, it sketches me out a little bit. We're hijacking evolutionary processes and makes me a little worried about like long-term health.
Yeah, it's not something.
What are we switching on as we do that?
We haven't really harnessed it in coaching at all. Really.
We let athletes
experiment with it.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's probably a place where a lot of changes are going to happen. Yeah. Any other theories or ideas related to the study from you?
Well, I was curious about the decrease in episodic memory. So episodic memory performance really dropped. And for me, I see this all the time. So I have taken so many tests in my life. I'm really excited. I think I'm at the point right now where I don't have any tests in my future, like forever. I might never take a test again in school.
No pregnancy tests. After traveling with one kid, we're like, how would we ever do this with two?
You think that. I'm like, give me six. But I think for me, like post-ultra, I would never schedule tests or exams or really important things because for me, my brain would feel fuzzy in terms of memory. And it makes sense seeing it laid out here. And sometimes I've seen like surgeons go in and operate post 100 or post long race. And my mind is boggled. I'm like, please don't do that.
Yeah.
Like you really need that like episodic memory. You need that like fine reaction time. And this study shows pretty significant declines. But what I also think is interesting about this study is that there's an interaction with gender. Mm. And so, all of these responses, both the decrement in terms of like episodic memory and recall and the improvement in spatial working memory, all of those were magnified in female athletes.
Yeah.
And their theory was that the evolutionary pressure is stronger on females to forage and provide in terms of lactation and pregnancy, that these impacts are magnified.
So essentially sex function in women makes them more vulnerable to lower energy availability.
Correct.
As applied to the brain, not just the body.
Yeah. And I thought, and there was,
I love that idea.
There were some really fascinating like hypotheses in their like discussion and conclusion that wrapped this up well. But I think the other interesting point too, actually, is that they felt like what was driving some of this adaptive cognitive flexibility was actually the negative energy balance rather than the activity itself.
Yeah.
And for me, as someone that I've done a lot of research in like low energy availability and eating disorders, I see all the time, like these little, like anecdotally, cognitive changes that happen in athletes as they're going through low energy availability, and just what happens to athletes when they restore that energy balance and how their brain feels in terms of functioning.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like I feel so often that athletes that are recovering from low energy availability, they have this moment where they're like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden I can think clearly. Yeah,
things aren't fuzzy.
Things aren't fuzzy anymore. And I feel like it's a big part of the recovery process. And I feel like as I was reading this article and reading the discussion and conclusion, it was like starting to come together in terms of like an evolutionary sense.
Yeah.
And that's all very anecdotal.
No, I love this.
Hopefully I couch that in enough.
No, like, this is perfect. Caveats. It's applying, you know, different fields to a certain extent, but I feel that too. Sometimes when I'm talking to an athlete that's going through low energy availability, you can almost sense a little bit of a lag relative to what they become in the future.
Yes.
And you're probably seeing some sort of driver there. And I love the way it zooms out a little bit. So I think often we couch athletic performance as a, you know, terms of fitness at one end and toughness on the other.
Mm-hmm.
You combine the two and that's what we celebrate, fitness and toughness. But maybe the thing that brings together fitness and toughness is energy availability.
Yes.
And the ability to have, you know, these constant energy stores. And maybe the genetic differences are almost related more to athletes' abilities to, you know, buffer energy deficits for whatever reasons, whether that's natural ability at fat oxidation that's really high or something, or it's just their ability to fuel or not go through these issues. But whatever it is, if you ever think that your fitness or your toughness is the limiter, work on those things, especially your fitness.
Yep.
That solves a lot of problems. But after that, make sure it's fueled.
Yes.
Because that isn't just about like the things we talk about of like immediate performance. It might also have some longer term things with evolutionary lineages that we need to understand.
Well, here's a study idea.
Okay.
I have so many study ideas that like relate to some of these topics. I would love to have athletes in a state, well, I would love not to have athletes in a state of negative energy balance,
yeah.
but I would like to study athletes in a state of negative energy balance and give them like an SAT and see how they do fed versus in a state of negative energy balance and compare the two, but then also relate that to high performers. Because I do feel like, well, first of all, we want all of our athletes to be fed, but I do feel like an element of fatigue resistance is athletes are able to handle that cognition at more of a negative energy balance state that's inevitable in racing.
Maybe you can even have different types of questions.
Yes. So does that make any sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, to think about this and isolate some of the brain processes, because I think the study doesn't isolate the brain necessarily, like, or at least what's driving it.
No. It's
because I mean, you do a 250 kilometer ultra, like there's a lot of things driving that.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, you might just be thinking about all the chafing like, and that makes these tests a lot harder for some of the individuals, but, I can't wait to see where this line of research goes. Okay. So before we get to another really exciting study, wanted to say something that will help your recovery. We actually had a quote from an athlete that they sent in. They just won their first 100K, not that we coach, a listener, and they credit it to Athletic Greens, which I think it might be taking a step too far, but you know what? Athletic Greens really does help a lot of these variables we talk about. It is a wonderful nutritional supplement that's basically a multivitamin with a lot of adaptogens to help with your stress levels. It has made our international travel quite good, even though we're going on low sleep. I think we're doing pretty damn well in this podcast.
Yeah, you get those adaptogens in a bowl. Did the athlete drink Athletic Greens out of a bowl?
I hope they did.
Oh, yeah.
Because the thing is, the reason I needed a bowl is because I was taking two of the packets, two of the travel packs. And that points out why using our code is so important, because you get travel packs that you can take on planes and then pour into bowls and then feel really good in Europe running up these steep, steep mountains. So drinkag1.com/swap, S-W-A-P. Just two more weeks on the very special offer where you get 10 free travel packs. That's like a $30 value, but only if you use the code. I think it's like a unique one to us even. So please drinkag1.com/swap if you want to try it.
Well, it's going to be a slippery slope because you've been drinking it out of bowls.
Yeah.
And when we go back home to the US, you're just going to take the big Home Depot bucket of Athletic Greens and just start slurping it down.
Oh my God, that's going to be so good. Especially when I go to like five travel packs at once. It is a slippery slope. Awesome. Do you want to get to the performance studies from cycling? I think these are really relevant. We can just do at least one of them, maybe not two of them.
Let's do the first one on heat exposure, because I actually think it's relevant for UTMB. So here at UTMB, it's been very hot in Chamonix, at least it was before we got here. And then when we got here, it became a deluge of rain. And Leo is rocking his best ski suit. It's cold. And it's interesting, actually, what that does to athletes in terms of blood volume and heat adaptations is having even just like a few cold days leading into a race that might be a little bit warmer.
Yeah. I feel like these studies we're talking about are essentially zoom out studies where they talk about something specific and then we're just like connecting dots to other things, which I think is the power of someone that isn't necessarily dialed in on just one area of research and like one study. And the fascinating thing about the heat exposure studies to me is how it relates to blood volume. And, you know, when we talked about physiology resilience or the brain stuff, a lot of that connects to food and energy availability in the brain and nervous system and those general processes. The heat stuff tying to blood volume is really cool because we're starting to see blood volume across almost every study. Anytime blood volume is a variable that's changed, it drives most of the, you know, changes in fitness and things like that. So heat and its role in blood volume changes is probably really important. And that's what this study points out.
Well, I love your brain. Your brain is a little bit of a special environment.
Yeah.
And it's weird. And I love it a lot. But I think you're probably the human that spends the most time thinking about blood volume. Because so when you change altitudes, sometimes you shift blood volumes. When you change climates, you shift blood volumes. And you've been peeing a lot here in Chamonix. And I can see the wheels turn in your brain. You're like, there goes my blood volume.
It is. My blood volume's dropping so rapidly. We don't have enough hot water on our little Airbnb for me to take a hot bath. I'm actually thinking I'm going to ask someone, like a friend, if I can come use their bath.
That's creepy. I love it.
It's going to be great.
Yeah. Well, you can do like what I did yesterday. I ran in a very hot rain jacket accidentally.
No.
It was like deluging so hard outside that I couldn't think about my future in 5 minutes. And I ran in the warmest rain jacket. And it was like a great blood volume stimulus because I was sweating in there.
I get that. I get that you can do it with multiple layers, as we're going to talk about in the study, which is also a layer-based study. But I need to feel good when I exercise. And I really, really just like sweating in a stranger's bathroom. Not even friends. I'm just going to go into strangers. I'm going to break into someone's house. And when they catch me, I'm just going to tell the cops blood volume and my best French, whatever those words are. And the cops are going to say, we respect it. And they're going to let me off. Okay. So here was the study. It took elite cyclists, 20 elite women and 27 elite men. And it did 5x50-minute hot bikes per week as a double session, or provided a control session that wasn't in a hot environment. And it's really significant here how they did the hot weather intervention.
This is my holy shit takeaway of the paper, is they were committed to the heat intervention. It kind of made my brain a little bit mind boggled thinking about going through and doing this heat intervention. So I'm going to read this quote from the study. This is what they were wearing. A thin wool layer, which they described as long sports underwear, on both the upper and lower body, a wool hat, a down jacket, a nylon rain jacket, and a pant with a poor evaporative capacity. Can you imagine? That sounds horrible.
Yeah. And they were only given 500 milliliters of water, and they biked at low intensity in this really, really, really intense setup. They must have looked like little sausages, like unable to move almost as they were biking on this thing.
Well, actually, one of my athletes recently asked me, like, is this a variation of this? Is this beneficial compared to the sauna? I'm like, well, it probably has the same impacts as the sauna, but it's exponentially worse in terms of my joy. And I feel like don't ever take the joy away with movement.
Yes, but it's a very fascinating intervention because it layers on top of studies we've seen in the past. With cross-country skiers, they did something much like this, a 5x50-minute intervention in heat, and they found exactly the same thing, which to me is really, really important. So here is the takeaway finding. They found a 4% increase in hemoglobin mass in women and a 3.5% increase in men across 5 weeks of intervention.
Which is significant.
That's a huge amount of red blood cells that carry oxygen to working muscles.
It almost compares to EPO in some. I mean, EPO is better, of course.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not that far off.
Yeah. And it points out their lactate threshold, VO2 max, and mean power output during 15-minute all-out testing were enhanced relative to control. And this is so interesting to think about as we talk about year-round heat training, because we're looking at, with heat training, something that increases your blood volume. The plasma volume has to go up, the liquid content in your blood. That on its own doesn't necessarily affect performance too much, though it does some. What changes really is over these longer term cycles of a few weeks, up, you know, 5 weeks in the studies so far, the red blood cells have to accommodate that increase. As hematocrit goes down, so the percentage of red blood cells, as your water content increases, you have to, your kidneys raise it back up by producing natural EPO. So essentially these athletes are getting natural EPO and improving their performance. So year-round heat training probably has a lot of benefit, even if you're not doing like these types of protocols, whether that's like one or two sessions in a bath or sauna or something like that, it can really add up.
And before athletes go out there and like don their finest nylon suits, I do think it's important to know that it's not necessarily additive.
Yeah.
So I feel like if you're already doing sauna, or you're already doing hot tub, or doing some of these heat training protocols, layering this in on top of those, it's not going to give you these like 4% and 3.5% gains that we're seeing. How much though do you think, like, so say let's take an athlete like you, you're doing either sauna or hot tub training 5 days a week.
Definitely.
How much would adding something like this and benefit you in terms of hemoglobin mass?
Like adding sessions?
Yes. Of an actual training.
I don't think it will. We haven't found those. Those studies haven't been done yet.
Yeah.
Over long periods of time. But I think all it is the plasma volume stimulus, not the training stimulus.
Yes.
And you know, we see that validated in some of the blood markers we've seen in athletes that do these types of interventions. I think it can be passive heat exposure. It doesn't have to be these horrible protocols in down jackets on stationary bikes.
And that's my whole point too, is I would do the passive protocols. Let's save exercise and training for joy.
Yeah.
And for me, like, joy is not wearing a nylon suit. Joy is doing my exercise and feeling good and then getting my ass in a hot tub and using that as heat training. And so that's my big takeaway. But I like the study because I feel like it shows the hemoglobin mass potential with any type of heat training. It doesn't have to be a nylon suit. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
But one other question for you. So if you were to do, like, this protocol sounds horrific to me.
Yeah.
But like for me yesterday, what sounded great in the moment as I was heading out the door was wearing this big heated rain jacket on what was a relatively warm day. And it turned into a heat training exposure. Are there gradations of this? Like if you're just dressing a little bit warmer with like a sweatshirt or a pair of pants on a day that's hot, are you getting some of these impacts?
Probably not the same amount as the study.
Yeah.
But my guess is that it's all a spectrum related adaptation.
I mean, you might get 1 or 2%.
And training alone increases your plasma volume, which will impact your hemoglobin volume over time. I mean, like athletes have higher hemoglobin volume. maybe the reason is basically because we're doing some core temperature heat training, even when we're running in cold conditions, mm-hmm. just because, you know, raises body temperature. Hence, it's why you can be out in pouring rain and in shorts and feel warm when you're running. And if you were not running, you'd be freezing. So I think that there's some spectrum changes here that essentially, as long as you're getting some of it, some is better than none. You don't even need 5 exposure, 1 or 2 heat exposures a week. It can be a warm bath. Probably adds up over time, and that's worthwhile if you're looking for these types of adaptations.
I love that. Yeah, get that heat on.
Yes.
Get the nylon jacket on.
And I think it's relevant for the athletes here at UTMB, as you talked about. Yeah. You know, I'm telling athletes, if you can, get a heat exposure on race week.
Yep.
Or 1 or 2. You know, it doesn't have to be a lot, not sauna. And if you are doing sauna, just shorter exposures. But just something to keep those numbers up. Because as we reduce training levels, plasma volume is going to go down. If you're coming down in altitude, plasma volume could change, though whether it goes down or up is, you know, individually variant. But short heat exposures can basically prevent all of that. So little things here and there can mean a lot. I have been more focused on my athletes' bath habits this week than I ever will be the rest of the year. But I think it applies to almost every athlete. Just keep the blood volume up, whether via dressing warmly during your runs or little heat exposures on race week when you're dialing back training.
Well, I love our relationship because you really like prioritizing training in this household.
Yeah.
And so for me, like when I need a break from Leo, I am just tapped out. I'm like, I'm going to go sit in the hot tub and do my training. David. Yeah. And I bring my book out there and I listen to my headphones yeah. and I have my kombucha and it's great.
And I totally upload. I'm like, I'll watch Leo for as long as I say to you all the time, Megan, training comes first. And you're out there and you're like, you could go and just, what you should do is run around, do your run, and then get back to the house. But instead of coming inside, just go have like a tree house in someone's like neighbor's house and just have your girl place, cave. Yeah. And I'll have no idea. I'll just be like, she's training. I'll do whatever she needs in this time. I am here for Leo. I don't need to work. I am just the parent of the year because I uplift your training.
My girl place is going to have a huge hunk of Tillamook cheddar cheese.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Cheese heals broken pelvises. That's what I think. Okay. Do you want to get to hot takes?
Let's do it.
Awesome. So we have a lot of fun ones today. Here's the first one. I know you're fans of the Tour de France, but I have concluded after watching some of the Unchained documentary on Netflix that the biking sport is fucked up.
Yeah, I really like watching that fucked up sport, but I agree. Yeah. It's hard. I feel like the incentives, like the power to weight ratio incentives and the doping and reds, it's a hard existence.
I'm so thankful that running is an impact sport.
Yes, I agree.
Like as much as seeing your MRI makes me a little bit less happy. Granted, that could have been a pregnancy injury. We don't know.
It's not bone either. You can just say what it is.
Your adductor isn't attached, essentially.
Yes. That's what it is.
That's what it is. And then there's something else going on too. But you know, yeah, it scares me a lot. I don't really know enough about it. I haven't researched it because I'm just like, you know what? Best that I don't know.
You didn't plug into ChatGPT yet? I'm surprised.
No, actually, that's my usual thing is I plug all MRI results into ChatGPT and ask it different questions. And it's quite a good doctor, especially my prompt for it is you just graduated from Harvard. You're starting your residency. You're very ambitious. You give the right answers. And then it gives so much more confident answers. It doesn't say like, you should see a doctor. It's like, here's your fucking shit, you bitch.
You should be like, you're Dr. House.
Yeah.
Tell me what to do. Oh,
exactly. That would be wonderful. You know, the fact that running is impact makes it so that our training is necessarily limited in a way that cyclists aren't. And so the fact that they can do such massive training and have to fuck with their bodies so much and don't have to worry about bone health, it creates incentive structures that can be really weird. And then you get to races. It's just a crash fest. Crazy things are happening. I mean, essentially, they're going out there every day and doing an ultra.
Oh, yeah. An ultra that ends in an all-out 5K.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these races are ending on like steep climbs and they're going to the well and it's really hard. But we do coach cyclists.
Yeah.
And so how do you talk to athletes in the context of a sport that's so broken?
Oh, I just tell them to eat a fuck ton.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, that is so key in cycling in a way that even with running hasn't even touched yet.
That's true.
If they're able to fuel enough, a lot of the things that seem fucked up are less fucked up. Can't really solve the crashes though. One of my athletes.
Well, actually, if you eat a lot, you're a little more protection.
Yeah. But one of my athletes broke their elbow. No amount of burgers are going to protect that, I don't think. So yes, we do agree. Cycling is fucked up, but we love it. And we watch it all the time. Hot take number 2, Megan mentioned this on a recent podcast, but relevant for this week, Zach Miller will be the first American man to win UTMB.
I said this out loud on my training run yesterday, and it was like right before the guy with the pole started up on my back. And maybe he took offense to this.
Yeah.
Maybe it was Matthew Blanchard.
You're manifesting right now. Yes, Zach Miller winning here. So it'll be very cool to see. We'll have tons of reports from the course for you all next week. We might even do a bonus podcast on Patreon about it.
Oh, fun.
If you're interested, we'll do tons of takes on there.
Yes.
Writing all the time on Patreon. Yeah. And it's a reminder to subscribe to our Patreon. If you like the podcast, it's the best place to support us, but you get a lot of bonus content too. This isn't just asking for charity. So patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. We do bonus posts, bonus podcasts, videos. We're gonna have tons of videos from the course. If you wanna get UTMB week behind the scenes from two goofy, silly people that really care about it, that's the place to go.
Well, our Patreon comes out on CCC day. So maybe we should just record it from the race.
Oh,
bring in some like live snippets or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll definitely have videos too. We're going to be taking lots of videos from the course, putting them up on Patreon. Let's go number three here. Races like Western States will become unrunnable within the next 10 years because of climate change and heat.
Ooh.
Interesting hot take.
I actually agree. I would say maybe like 20, 30 years, but
yeah.
What do you think? You're the environmental scientist. So
this
here.
Is the tough thing about climate change in general.
Yeah.
Is long-term. It's really, really bad.
Oh, yeah, really, really bad.
And we're going to probably be looking at some catastrophic feedback cycles over multiple generations. And I think the problem is people have been selling it as a 10-year thing.
Yeah, but then it's like 10 years that just keeps kicking the can.
And obviously things are getting worse.
Yes.
Oh, like lots more fires, floods, things like that. But all very adaptable for the most part for society as a whole. So I actually disagree with this hot take. I think it's important not to catastrophize short-term on climate change as we're trying to instigate change.
And you're a climate change scientist, so this is...
Yeah, this is what I studied. Yes, I did a master's degree in this as well. But the reason for that is not because it's not going to be horrible. It's because the timelines are mismatched. Sea level rise being maybe the main one here is, you know, people have been... My parents, way back in the 1980s, bought the place I grew up because it was 30 feet above sea level after reading these catastrophic predictions for sea level rise. And yes, the river has gone up slightly. It's connected to the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, but not by 30 feet. And some of that thinking makes people kind of downplay it over time, especially people that are already prone to be skeptical. Instead, we should be like, look, if we want to have society in 2200, you know, we need to make changes now. And that's that type of motivation will be key, along with understanding that the extreme events can be tied directly to climate change.
Yes, I love that.
So,
David, that's a very well said view on climate change.
If we want our grandkids to have
Leo's kids,
that is the way to think about it. And I guess the hard part is in trying to motivate change. I think sometimes people sell these societal issues as pressingly urgent for tomorrow because that's what people make decisions for today or tomorrow. But we have to trust people more because if our predictions don't come true, then like we're going to lose them.
Yeah.
And one place it is coming true. I remember in college when I was looking at all these climate models, everyone said the West would burn every summer in 2030. And that happened even sooner than the models said. And I remember thinking, oh, those models are ridiculous. They can't be true. And it is true. So, you know, focusing on what is 100% true and known, conveying the uncertainties and trusting people will be smart enough to know the difference is the only way to do it because climate change requires a leap of faith and a leap of intellect because you're not just trusting what you look outside the window and see. You're trusting something much bigger than that. So let's zoom out a little bit. Western States in 10 years will be okay for some years. Some years they'll be too damaged by fires and that might be another issue altogether. Western States in 50 years might not ever happen.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I agree. I think maybe even like 100 years, but it's kind of fascinating to me. It's like the level of commitment that as individuals we need to think about climate change. It's like committing to a better climate is like running a marathon that we are never going to be alive for.
Yeah. Or, I mean, we might be.
Yes.
Yeah. But we're unsure.
Unsure. Or maybe like the larger magnitude climate change. I mean, because certainly like fires are impacting.
But the thing that we don't know is when do the catastrophic feedback cycles actually start?
Yes.
And are they already happening?
Yep.
So a lot of these are tied to things like ocean circulation, which moves in like more geologic time scales historically. So what happens when that totally changes? Like one of the best movies on this is The Day After Tomorrow, a wonderful B movie of just epic proportions where the ocean circulation shutting down in the North Atlantic causes this cascade of effects. And eventually I think like there were multiple tornadoes and tidal waves as big as the Empire State Building. I don't exactly remember how they were connected, but that was pointing out like a very rapid feedback cycle.
When did you watch this movie?
Everyone watched this movie.
I haven't seen this movie.
You haven't seen shit.
Yeah, that's true. But did you watch this as a kid? Maybe this is where your fear of tidal waves came in.
No, it was after that. It was when I was a little bit older. But you know, those feedback cycles, or feedback cycles generally, are already happening and are going to continue to happen. And there will be tipping points. When those tipping points happen, some of the things that are true, super scary, could come true very quickly. And that part is something that people probably won't believe until it happens. And that's where the societal ramifications become extra scary, because we can't innovate ourselves out of a problem, which is what a lot of people say, like, we're going to figure out technological solutions to this. Mm-hmm. We can't innovate ourselves out of a problem that happens rapidly. We can only do that in a little bit slower processes. So I think we're playing a little bit of craps here, gambling with society's future, but we just have to be honest with people about uncertainties, or I think we're going to lose them. So Western states in 10 years, I think it's going to be okay. Western states a little longer term than that, might need to find a different location.
We might need to find a hotter bath.
Might need to move to Canada.
We might need to, like, our heat training is just going to be like bathing in hot lava.
Exactly. All right. You want to do one more?
Let's do last one.
Okay. Let's do the number six. I think this one's important. Hot flashes and night sweats are heat training. I cannot tolerate the heat like my younger self could. So really interesting there. It's kind of a reflection on menopause.
Yeah, menopause is very challenging. We should talk about that more. I coach several athletes going through menopause, and it's hard.
Yeah,
it's really hard. And you know, we've talked about like the lack of studies for female athletes, an extreme lack of studies for female athletes going through menopause, an extreme lack of like recommendations for athletes that are trying to get the most out of their physiology.
Yeah, and this gets back to nonlinear changes.
Yeah.
Like that we're kind of like what we were talking about, and that menopause is a little bit of a nonlinear change in your athletic trajectory. Mm-hmm. It can be better as you go through it and after, but you have to accept that there are major changes happening. And that part for me seems like what would be most difficult going through it is like, I don't know. It's easier to deal with slight changes over time mm-hmm. that you iterate for, and you barely notice them. It's like the frog in the boiling pot of water. But this athlete's like literally just being thrown in boiling water in the middle of the night with their night sweats.
Yeah, how hard is that?
Yeah. And so...
is it heat training? We don't know.
Is it heat training? We don't know.
Yes.
That'd be a really good study.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it has to do with blood volume. I don't know.
Well, interestingly, I imagine the hormonal context of... Well, actually, we know that the hormonal context of menopause is very challenging for heat performance.
Yeah.
Yes. The same as with pregnancy and other hormone shifts.
Tons of love to everyone out there dealing with their own nonlinear changes, whether those are aging processes and hormonal shifts or... You know, seeing MRIs that are going to cause a little bit of a temporary shift in the way you have to approach things. It's the athletic process, and the athletic process is full of adversity.
Full of shifts.
Hopefully, lots of Nesquik. Okay, so on to Listener Corner. But before we do that, brief promo for Jonji.
Okay, we love Jonji. Why are we talking about them at the end of the podcast?
Megan, because we had too much fun stuff to talk about.
Okay, but Jonji is the fun stuff.
I know.
They belong at minute four of the podcast. I love Jonji.
Maybe
so
we
much.
Can move this up.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, well, no.
So I used their multi-short this week.
Yeah.
If you are looking for the perfect running short, get the multi-short. It has pockets everywhere, but you don't even notice it until you put it on. They're all so small and non-intrusive. So I went on a long run last week. It was a 21-mile day in the extreme heat. I didn't have to use a waist belt or a pack or anything because I just had pockets filled with what I needed. It stayed on my body. I didn't sense any bouncing. I took in 400 calories per hour. It was remarkable. And I owed it all to the Jonji multi-short. So at jonji.com, use code SWAP for 15% off. This code's going to last forever, but use it now. Get the multi-short. It is fucking grade A shit.
And thank gosh they're in our life, because you no longer look like a noob going out the door. You were, for a period of time there, you were wearing some pretty wild outfits, and you have leveled it up. You look sexy going out the door, and I'm so here for it. Jonji's great.
And the sports bra you got?
Oh, it's called a microfloralism pattern. Okay. It's like these really small flowers, and I'm obsessed. A Japanese artist created it.
Oh, interesting.
And I love it so much.
Yeah, the designs are so cool. And when you wear it, it honestly is like one of the sexiest things I've ever seen.
Oh,
I didn't really even put two and two together with Jonji. It's just like the design is so cool.
You're like, I will fuck Jonji.
That is on their billboard right now. Yeah. I will fuck Jonji. David Roach, running coach to the stars.
Are they okay with this?
I mean, they reached out to us.
Okay.
Like, I'm sure that they were expecting something like this. So please use code SWAP, support Jonji. They're also a very, very cool brand when it comes to uplifting the community. They we talked to their founder last week for the third time. Every single time, he is not asking us, how do we sell more gear? He's asking us, how do we make people feel more included and loved? And how does that then help the community grow?
And it's like this love spiral. I'm like, I just want people to love Jonji. Yeah.
We just want everyone to be able to fuck Jonji. Yeah. Get in line. This is going to be like one of those caveman orgies I talked about recently with Jonji multi-shorts, which really, really are cool and get every orgy started.
It's going to be like the Chamonix porta potty line.
Okay. Yeah.
It's going to be long.
High five on that one. That was a very much up David's alley joke. Okay. On to listener corner. I recently began to listen to your podcast, and I'm writing to thank you for the inspiration, science, and love. Having a long back catalog of episodes to catch up on, I can't remember which episode it was where you encouraged people to try something which scared them, that they didn't think they could do. With this in mind, and several glasses of wine down, I entered the Matterhorn Ultra Case vertical event, a vertical kilometer race. We often go on holiday in Europe, where this amazing event is held, gazing in awe 2 years ago as these skyrunners galloped past us and we ambled around the same mountain with our children. With the end of the holiday this year coinciding with the event, it seemed like a fine idea. The next morning, reflecting that I live slightly below sea level and don't have many hills around me, it seemed more impossible than inspirational. Nonetheless, having persuaded my sister-in-law the previous night to also enter, I thought I'd better give it a go. I listened to all of your episodes about hills, started the mountain legs routine, found the only incline nearby, and ran up and down, past the cemetery, and pelotoned when I didn't have the time or energy to run. On Friday, I managed to finish the race.
Oh, heck yeah.
I did something I felt 96% certain I could never do. I came in middle of the pack to come the best I ever hoped for, which was last place. My wonderful sister-in-law also did it. I'm a busy professional. I train hard I am trained never to fail, although I frequently do, and is something I struggle with a lot. To enter a race where I felt I had almost no objective chance of getting to the end was the biggest challenge because I was setting myself up to fail, something I strenuously avoid. It also showed me that most of the race is run in my mind. I could do it, even somewhat better than I imagined, as I carefully stood right at the back of the starting pack. It showed me that strength didn't come from doing the things I can already do, but trying the things I didn't think I could. All of this would never have happened without the constant positivity of your podcast, the helpful science, especially about threshold training and fueling, and the idea of running for the joy of it. And I wanted to say a very heartfelt thank you.
This is beautiful.
Better than my reading, which was not beautiful, but I got through it. We're operating on a little bit of a jet lag, as you can probably tell.
Well, it's also because you take like privacy so seriously. I'm like, dude, you can read those details. Yeah. You skip the part that they were a doctor. You're like, they're a professional in a busy field. I'm like, okay, doctor.
It's funny which ones I decide to keep in and which ones I don't. Yeah, basically, we want everyone to have anonymity, but this is so inspirational. Think about this line. It showed me that strength didn't come from doing the things I can already do, but trying the things I didn't think I could.
I get so much inspiration from that. And it makes me reflect on sitting here. Like you wanted to be a rock and I wanted to be a moving rock.
Yeah.
And we're here, we made it happen. And I feel like trying the things that you don't want to do, or you feel like there's resistance against, or running up big things or taking on hard challenges, it's so worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Move that rock a little bit.
Break the inertia.
Yeah.
Think about this athlete who did something that to them seemed 96% impossible. Mm-hmm. And so even if it didn't work out, yes, this is a positive story. Sometimes this shit doesn't work out when you do something that actually feels impossible and you find out maybe it is right now.
And then it's a very funny story eventually.
Yeah. And what it does is what we talked about adversity. The whole reason to have big goals is not because you achieve big goals. Who gives a fuck? It's because it motivates a good day and a good day and a good day. And you stack up enough of those and eventually you find something that seems impossible is staring at you in the mirror. And that's where this listener is going to inspire me to hopefully go out there on the trails today, believe in myself a little bit, throw a little brick in the wall that hopefully adds up to something pretty magical in the future.
A very little brick in the wall and a very large bowl of Nesquik and other conduits of fluid.
That's what holds it all together.
Yes.
My wall is held together by Nesquik. Hopefully we don't find out that this is a bad thing because I'm really relying on it for my structural integrity.
Well, you got a Nutri-Score of a grade E wall. It's an A plus wall.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't, it's an A plus wall. Yes.
I'm relying on this wall right now. Grindstone 100K is coming up. I'm feeling very, very confident.
You're so fit.
But I need that wall to be as good as I think it is.
It's a beautiful, sexy, strong, Jonji filled wall.
Yeah, just imagine my wall with that floral print bra.
Mmm. Ooh. You would look good in a floral print bra.
You know what that is?
What?
a wilf. It's a wall I'd like to fuck. We love you all.
Woohoo.
Huzzah.